Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
I think you have to look in the long term of history in order to try to understand the future. So firmly, cities will bounce back. The city will continue to be the machine for social and economic transaction that it always has been.
As city dwellers all over the globe slowly start to creep back into their urban centres, we explore what form these hubs of business and society will take. Will the office look and function the same as before? Will the CBD ever return to its former glories? On today's episode, we take stock of more than a year's worth of temporary urbanism, behavioural data, and new normal thinking in our urban cores to find out the best way to repopulate the centre. That's all ahead in the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist, with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to today's programme. A few months ago on The Urbanist, when the global pandemic still had a strong grip on the UK and the country was facing a new wave of infections, we released a show looking at the fate of the central business district. It included some blue sky ideas for a future that at the time seemed a very long way off. Now in May, and as some cities such as London are starting to see companies invite staff back into their CBDs, we wanted to look at what data we had gathered over the past year and how we can use what we've learned to rethink the way that we occupy our city centres. Well, joining me now is Tim Stoner, the Managing Director of Space Syntax, an architecture and urban planning organisation who have developed technologies that predict human behaviour to help plan the future of our cities for the public, private and also community sectors. Tim, thank you for speaking with us today. I'm interested in how this technology that you've developed might have been affected by the pandemic and the changes in people's behaviour. When you imagine city centres starting to be occupied again, do you have to think about the fact that all of the good work you've done might suddenly have a few wrinkles in it that need ironing out?
Of course, and that's because life has changed for all of us. But at the same time, I think it helps validate the approaches that were being taken in the right directions around, for example, local place, around walking and cycling as alternatives to taking the train, taking the bus. And therefore, in some ways, looking for the silver lining, which I like to do, is saying, well, how can COVID be an accelerant of the good change that was already happening? And I and many others in many organizations, including my own, have been increasingly working from home in the years leading up to COVID. And COVID has just accelerated that, enhanced that. And it'll be a change that will stay. It doesn't mean I want to stay working from home all the time. I might want to work from near home, which means the place I live in, the local community I'm part of, there's the opportunity for places of work that are also places of social interaction, which every good office should be. So the cafe culture of local towns and neighbourhoods can benefit. And city centres will have to change, and there will no doubt be some shock and trauma along the way. The office rental market is facing huge difficulties as organisations either need less space or can't afford the space that they had before. And there's going to be a lot of vacancy. I think that'll lead to innovation, and the kinds of tools that we use are helping people think through, well, what happens if half our workforce isn't in the office? They're working from home. What sort of needs will my organization need to cater for?
If I was a client coming to you, and, you know, I see you've done work places like Margate here, a coastal town here in the UK, and you know, your mission statement is that you need thriving life in places. So some of these places are going to bounce back, others are going to have a more questionable future. But if I came to you and said, I want this, this is what I want for my city, I want thriving life on the streets, and we've just gone through the pandemic, do you think you're still at this point in the story able to say, actually, you can have that, but you need to now think about providing more spaces for people to work, as you say, close to home. You need to rethink what your retail mission is because it's not going to look like the past. Is that the kind of granular stuff that you would try and get involved in?
Yeah, I think more than ever, we need thriving life. And the street, just to take the street as an example, as a component of recovery, that we need to make streets far more human friendly. And that comes down to a number of things, basic things like the speed at which cars drive. So we need to slow streets down. 20 miles an hour should be the national default speed limit in the UK, and it still isn't. Places have slowed down their traffic during COVID. The town I live in, we finally, after 5 years of campaigning, achieved a town-wide speed limit. That makes it now much easier to generate thriving life because it encourages walking. People feel safer walking alongside slower moving traffic. And we also then need to change basic things like where people can sit down, the lack of benches, the lack of, they're so sort of granular and seemingly insignificant until you take them in the collective. If we re-skin our streets by slowing them down, by making them more pedestrian friendly, then we can provide the alternative forms of lifestyles to the ones that we were previously wedded to, i.e. car dependency, the commute into the 9-to-5 workplace.
Now, some of these things are clear, you know, the need to cut carbon emissions to tackle climate change. These things are kind of fixed, and we know we should be kind of doing our best to bring those about. The bit I keep on finding intriguing at the moment is, you know, that when people are making big decisions, whether it's about infrastructure or planning our cities or the built environment, there are still so many unknowns. You know, the predictions, you can open a paper, you can hear people giving talks which range from the city is dead, it will never bounce back, it's doomed, CBDs will never return. And then you hear other people saying, actually, you know, we're determined to get our workforce back into the City of London, for example. How can people begin to make these very important decisions when the data is still a bit opaque about what behaviour will look like in the future?
I think you have to look in the long term of history in order to try to understand the future. So firmly, cities will bounce back. The city will continue to be the important machine for transaction, the machine for social and economic transaction that it always has been. You know, for as long as we've had societies, we've had cities, and I'm sure you've heard this from other people speaking with you before, but cities are crucibles of invention. Cities are collectors of ideas, generators of innovations. And they do that through very understandable mechanisms, through the connectivity of streets, through the mixing of land uses, through density, through slow speed. All of these are measurable. What we haven't had, though, and I think that leads to a lot of the uncertainty that you talk about, what we haven't had are the tools to understand exactly how cities work. And that's the gap that Space Syntax is helping to fill. So when it comes to zero carbon or low carbon living, another of the tools we're currently working on is a zero carbon tool that measures transport carbon, where a lot of the discussion around carbon has been on insulation and local energy generation, and rightly so. But if you like the architecture of low carbon, how you build well-insulated buildings. But if you build the best well-insulated building in a car-dependent enclave, then you're consigning people to burning fossil fuels, at least in the short term, running electric vehicles in the long term, but that electricity has to come from somewhere. That is not zero carbon.
On your website, you have this great quote from Norman Foster saying he loves your work and he loves this access to analysis and data. But he also says, you know, that he likes how that then intersects with the world of having a hunch about what's good. When I was looking at all this, the amazing things that you do, and I would encourage people to look at your site, it's really fascinating, all the work you do. But it struck me that in years past, in centuries past, that, you know, you didn't need to have all this data to create spaces where people naturally mingled, you know, that whether you were building a piazza in Italy, people just had an innate understanding about planning, it seems like, about how to bring people together on the street, where you needed a market, a nice density for your city, all of these things. How did that get lost to the point that architects actually don't understand some very basic things about how people would feel when they walked through the front door of a building, or where would be the points where they could meet their friends to sit in a nice square and have a conversation? How did that all get lost from the world of architecture?
Yeah, why on earth do we need a science of the blindingly obvious to make the cities that we all know and love and feel? Well, I think there's a number of reasons. First, we didn't have the motor car. Second, we didn't have large-scale, rapid construction abilities. And thirdly, we didn't have the separation of professions, which has led to isolated, insular, siloed methods of thinking, where we've separated architecture from town planning. We've separated town planning from transport planning. We've got groups of professionals educated as seeming experts in their own domains who don't know how to talk to each other. And the convenience of the house builders, transport planners' solution to all of this is, I'll build you a trunk road, you build a housing estate, and actually we don't really need architects anymore. We'll put them in for the higher end housing. And it's a siloed diagram of convenience, which strips away all the subtlety, all the slow incremental learning that came from the kinds of slow growth, small scale growth that cities had for centuries. And that the motor car and the Industrial Revolution then accelerated and scaled to the point where we became addicted to this form of car-based lifestyle. And now we're educated into it as well. There's a huge amount of inertia, professional inertia in our systems. We're trying to use space as the lowest common denominator, as the common language that all of these professions speak, to act as a bridge between them, and then to give them tools to understand that there's actually an alternative diagram, which is the slow connected city. And guess what? To the investors of the world and the property developers, it makes more money. And so once you can bring the economics into this, you can understand that that siloed way of car dependency is actually not only damaging to the climate, not only damaging to health, but it's also damaging to the bottom line. And somewhere in there, it gives someone a good reason to change things.
Tim Stoner, Managing Director of Space Syntax, along with a hopeful sounding dawn chorus in the background, thank you very much for joining me. Up next on The Urbanist, we look at the changing nature of office spaces in our cities. Stay with us. The heart of the central business district is, of course, business. So for the second half of the show, we're going to turn our gaze to the office. An occupied office isn't just important to the building owner's books. It's vital in getting people back through the door of retail, hospitality, and entertainment venues. But will our offices look the same upon return? And should they? Well, I'm joined now by Hugo Jamson, Creative Director at London-based creative practice New Territory, who have recently published 7 future city concepts which imagine city centre buildings as more porous, agile and flexible to better serve the post-pandemic world. Well, Hugo, thank you for joining us today. Perhaps, first of all, tell us a little bit about New Territory. How do you explain to people the work that you do?
At the heart of what we do is really, we try and develop solutions to big, complicated problems. So we worked in mobility for many years. We work in aerospace, rail, automotive. And the learnings from that are that you can't really deal with any one of the attributes of a customer experience without looking at the rest. So we talk quite a lot about people, place and product as being interwoven and integral to developing these. And our learnings for that are helping us do work in the real estate sector, retail. We work with tech firms on logistics in order to develop new service propositions and experiences. So complexity is sort of our friend, and we try and help these businesses and brands navigate that grey area and join the dots as well, because we have this belief that living, working and moving are where we work, and all of those things are so interconnected at different times in our day and through the different brands that we experience.
We wanted to talk to you because you've been putting out some interesting papers, pieces of thought leadership for urbanism, for design, for the creative industries. And one of them is about some concepts for how our cities might look in the future. And part of that, obviously, we want to talk to you about is how we reignite our urban cores going ahead, how we get people back into the city and enjoying the spaces and using them in new and fresh ways. How central do you think this notion of what the future of the office is, what the future of the tab lock is, if we're going to think fresh about our cities?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I think what we've noticed throughout this year that we've all gone through, I think, is that there's a kind of fragility to monocultures in urban spaces and places. And I feel like the traditional idea of, you know, an office central core, the buildings that we develop to service that particular model, and the ecosystem of businesses that surround that are quite fragile. And I think it's important in the future to start to think about different ways of building a more resilient ecosystem to replace that.
And again, one of the seven ideas you have about this was a more agile floor plate, where maybe these buildings have factories in them, they have workspaces, they have pop-ups, they have offices and more traditional uses as well. Could you just explain a little bit about that idea as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, going back to that idea of monocultures, and I think that's true of the building, and it's often true in denser office areas, the centre, like the city. So I think trying to introduce a richer mix for a number of reasons. You know, I think a richer mix within a building is valuable to people coming back to those office buildings. You know, different reason to come back, a different set of actors within that space that are going to create a richer environment. You know, there hopefully would be different activities or different opportunities within a single building. I think another point is using space in cities more efficiently and effectively, and giving space where possible to people who wouldn't necessarily have access to it. So I think there's an inclusivity angle to it. And also time-based. I think cities naturally have a rhythm which is based around that monoculture. And when we potentially, if we think about a building with different working actors within it, or different working people or different activities, then maybe we can stretch that, and that building and that neighborhood becomes useful for a longer period, you know, beyond the 9 to 5. And I think also it's not just about within the building. I think by doing that, you could start to enrich the neighborhood that surrounds that building or that network of buildings. That's another angle that we talked about, which is that I think it's so often developers and building owners consider their remit largely to end at the door. And I feel like it would be of benefit to them and be of benefit to their tenants, and it would be of benefit to the people, that the businesses that surround those buildings, if they were to consider the street as part of their realm as well, to start to sort of bleed out, as it were, in terms of where they consider the experience to be for their tenants.
It's interesting. I was actually in the financial core of London, in the city of London this morning, and incredibly quiet still. Many financial service companies and banks are still not bringing their staff back in. And there you see this monoculture is extreme, where you have these very tall towers which only service the people in them at any one time. Whereas I think what's interesting is if you go to Asia, that isn't the case. You can go to like a financial district in, I don't know, in Tokyo, for example, and there in somewhere like Marunouchi, you'll find a tower that has retail all the way up to maybe on the 20th floor. There's a section that's a hotel. There's a section that's offices. There's maybe even residential, all in the same block. So that again, when things, if they did shut down or something happens, there's still something always going on. And again, if you have a restaurant culture several floors high up of a tower, that you're pulling in people at night time and you're making use of the building more than just from 9 to 5, as it were.
Completely. Yeah, I think it's such a good example in Tokyo, you know, where there are restaurants, you go up in a lift and the doors open and the decor and the sense of where you are changes completely. And I think there's, yeah, as you say, I think that sort of builds a different purpose to going into the center of a city. I also like Hong Kong as an example of, you know, horizontal spaces between buildings across the city. And I can't remember the name, but I know books have been written about it and how interesting it is for more, you know, agile, small scale, pop up, for want of a better word, uses of those spaces. And it feels like the more we can do that, and the more we can think about opening them up, I think you create more interesting places. It goes back to that idea that you create more reason ultimately for tenants to want to be in that space and for workers to go back, because they're getting more for their hour in that city centre.
Hugo Jamson, Creative Director at New Territory, thank you for joining me on The Urbanist. Lastly today, we wanted to look behind the scenes of the office real estate world to see what trends we can see from the past 12 months and what predictions we can make for how office space will be used in the future. Well, I'm joined now down the line by Beth Hampson. Beth is Commercial Director of the Argyle Club, a London office space provider with 38 assets across the central city that provide workspaces, virtual addresses, and co-working facilities for their customers. Beth, it's been a turbulent year for your industry. I'm sure faith in the office was shattered over the past year, and mass city exodus seemed to be predicted at every turn. Looking now, as London begins to repopulate and office workers start to return, what sort of customers are the first to take up space in the city again?
It's interesting. I mean, our addresses are prime central London, so it depends in terms of sectors based on which area. But in Mayfair, we're seeing sort of the hedge funds coming back and investment firms. So people who need to have face-to-face meetings, whereby the benefit of a central London meeting space, office space address complements them for investment purposes, especially right now when they're trying to gear up their funding. And then in the city, we've actually seen quite a lot of our law firms starting to come back, but primarily the sort of more financial investment, financial services. Again, similar to the hedge funds in Mayfair, the ones who really need to have that face-to-face contact and for brand images perception, having face-to-face meetings has been key to them rather than being across sort of Zoom.
I guess there's been a lot of talk about enticing people back into the office and how business mindsets have changed over the course of the pandemic. Do you think that's somewhat overplayed, or are your customers approaching you with new and different needs than before?
So I would probably start sort of pre-corona. I think if we look pre-corona, most of the contracts or how we work day to day, we were working in a far more flexible, agile manner. Phone contracts weren't sort of 24, 36 months, it might have been 12 months. Different types of contracts we were negotiating or business plans were maybe looking at the 2 to 3 years out and becoming more flexible. I think in terms of the real estate market, we were slowly moving towards that. So the move from conventional to flexible workspace was happening. But I think Corona was the catalyst that really, well, actually Brexit was the initial part of the catalyst. And then Corona sort of kickstarted that even further, which caused people to look at their real estate setup and what were their needs more closely because of those two sort of quite major events that were happening. I think most people that we've seen coming back, and we actually saw it during Corona as well, there's definitely a need for office space. People are looking at how they are working. And I think what we've seen is people are taking the space they need. So if they're working in two different teams, they might take a slightly smaller office, but rotating in. People are also looking at location being the first and foremost. So the address is really the most valuable part, because if they're taking a smaller office, their address is their brand. They are branding in that way. And people are looking at the sort of types of locations. So having areas which are complemented by the cafes around them, so they can pop out, have a break from the working day, but be very close to where their office is. So those sort of central hubs is key coming through. We saw the start of that happening pre-corona, and actually interestingly during the sort of pandemic, our volume of deals that we did in terms of new business was only about 15% less than what it was pre-corona. And that's what we've seen flow very much into this year, albeit we're moving back up to pre-corona levels.
Beth, when we look specifically at London, and when you look at some of the deals you're making and conversations you're having, what do you see as the potential risks ahead? And are you still confident that London will ultimately be okay?
Very much so. Look, I think firms like Goldman Sachs have announced that they're going back to their office place full time. I'm confident people will return to the office. We've seen that in our footfall of our buildings coming through. People are craving face-to-face meetings and interaction, because I think we've seen it internally ourselves. You can't sort of have the same level of meeting that you would have in the office, because actually such a large proportion of innovation and creativity doesn't just happen in that one-hour meeting. It's the conversations you have in the kitchen. It's the ones you have up the corridor towards the meeting, after the meeting when you're reflecting, just going, oh, actually, I've just thought about that point, or can I show you how to work? So I'm very confident, and I think complemented by large major firms also being confident of the return to London, London and the office space is definitely going to thrive. And that will mean more people back in central London, which will mean the rest of the economy, different retail shops, because they all feed off that footfall coming back into central London, will continue to thrive. So I still see London being a busy hub. In terms of the risks that we've got or main concerns, I think as senior directors or anyone running a company, one of the major concerns I think all of us need to think about is what the last 12 months have played on us and the development of our teams. I think we've heard a lot in the press, which rightly so, we need to get kids back to school, their learning and development so key. That continues the whole way through our lives, and learning, developing, shadowing, mentoring. A lot of people and a lot of people starting their career haven't had that for the last 12 months. So I think we need to be really mindful to ensure that our teams and companies are really working to develop our staff, so we don't have sort of a generation which is anywhere dipped off where we want it to be, and we're supporting them to be the future leaders of the companies that they're working for or others.
Beth, tell me about the atmosphere within your spaces. You present quite a slick and grown-up style of workspace. Are you now finding that customers want softer and perhaps more fun spaces? Or is presenting a polished image still just as important as ever?
I think the nature of our clientele has been that we have always had quite a large square footage per person in the offices. We have, your word, sort of grown-up businesses. So it's sort of the very established, they liked our space, so they chose our spaces because it wasn't sort of small square footages and just looking at it on a desk space. It was looking at holistically as a wider office piece. We do see that throughout the day, people do like different types of spaces to work in, albeit if it's in their office, they might have a small meeting room table or the lounge facilities. And we've made sure they are all safe, secure. And our clients, we've seen lots of people using those since people have been coming back to the office. So I haven't seen a major change in that respect. I'd say one of the things we have seen is if it's a larger company, say 20 people, 30 people, they might be taking a sort of, if it's a 30 person office, a 15 to 20 person office, and having the space that they're working in two teams initially whilst we get through the next few months. That's probably the bigger change that we're seeing, that they know they want an office. They know they've got staff members they're wanting to come in, but they're choosing to work on a rotation with the view that when it sort of settles down, the vaccine continues to roll out, they'll then upsize when that's necessary and take the space that they do want to end up in within our buildings.
Well, Beth, lastly, I wanted to look at the kinds of workers who you think will be common in the future. We've seen this nomadic business person championed a lot recently, and you do, for example, offer hourly rates for these sorts of customers. Do you see the numbers of these types of workers growing, or do you imagine that the majority of people will end up going back to work, say, 3 or 4 days solid in an office?
Yeah, it's interesting. And again, I think a lot of our clients, they would have had an office full time, but they might not have always used it full time. So they might have had sort of historically been a bit more flexible about days they've coming in. So for us, as I said, I don't think people will want sort of a 3 day a week office, because actually your office is your brand. So being able to have it that it's your space. So I think people will take a slightly smaller office and rotate their teams in to have flexibility rather than needing a kind of shared office for 3 days. That's how I see it going more, mainly because the types of clients we have, security and privacy is so key to them. So they'd rather have the four walls private office space that we predominantly sell, and then they work within their sort of flexible working if they need it around that.
That's Beth Hampson, Commercial Director of the Argyle Club in London, and thank you to her. And that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. And David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, well, here's Curtis Mayfield with Back to the World. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. Must have been with you, and now that